Okay, by my count, we should be rolling, so let's get started. Today we're going to move on to sort of the next segment of the class, Geography 12. We're going to look at cartometry. That's a very easy term to unravel. Carto just means maps, and metri just means measuring, so taking measurements from maps. I've introduced the idea before. Now it's going to get a little bit more real. So I'm going to start with the easy parts, which is positioning and distance. And we're going to do quite a bit of positioning. We're going to start with simple point and pairs of points. You'll see what I mean by that in just a minute. Basically, it means locations, distances, and bearings. We're going to cover distances and bearings today. And then we'll go on and look at line and area features in the next lecture. And then we'll move on to positioning using GPS. So we'll have a lecture on the global positioning system next week. Okay, long-winded introduction. We've introduced this idea already. You might say it's the last of those map transformations that I introduced at the start of the quarter. The map is a model, so the map is a model, or it's a representation of reality, and we can do things to the map and have them represent things in the real world. So if the map model is geometrically faithful to the real world and accurate, and notice that we're always going to have some inaccuracies because of things like projections and issues to do with scaling, then we can make measurements, navigation decisions, we can analyze and interpret the landscape, assuming that the same conclusions apply to the real world. A map is not the real world, but it's pretty easy to work with compared to the alternatives. Okay, I introduced this idea, cartometry. What is it? Well, any time we make a measurement from a map and apply that measurement to the real world, then we've done cartometry. So if we measure the distance from point A to point B with a piece of string, hold it up against the scale on the map, and say that's 1.7 kilometers, then we have done cartometry. And the link to reality is through the map scale. Obviously, we have to know about the map scale transformation to be able to accurately calculate those distances. All right, so what are the things that we can measure in cartometry? Well, turns out we can measure quite a lot. If we use this feature model of maps, I'm going to reintroduce it and sort of bludgeon you over the head with it eventually, and that's the idea that the world contains point features, line features, and area features, and we can represent those on maps as points, lines, and areas. We have to add labels and text in here as well to be able to represent it on the map. So on the map, we have point symbols like that benchmark at the top of this mountain, line symbols like these contour lines, area symbols like the vegetation patterns being shown here on the sides of the map, and labels, the labels on the contour and the labels on the elevations on this particular instance. Okay, they're just symbols. We're going to interpret them, and we're going to use those to make conclusions about the real world. So let me introduce you to a really remarkable place. It's called Nowhere. That's Nowhere with a capital N. And as I say in the new book I'm working on right now, even nowhere is somewhere. Okay? In other words, we have a coordinate reference for this location in Oklahoma. Today's deliberate quiz, what coordinate system are these coordinates in? We have an easting. It's in the hundreds of thousands of meters. You see it's greater than 500,000. We have a northing. It's in the millions. We have a number 14 and an S. Yes? Correct. It's in UTM, but in the civilian version of the UTM system, not the military grid reference system. Okay, so this is sufficient to give us a location down to the nearest meter, although you see this has been rounded. There it is, Nowhere, Oklahoma. It's a real place. Again, it's one of these accidents of fate. A couple from California resettled into Oklahoma, and the wife and the family said, "You've taken me to the middle of nowhere." So the guy went out the back where he had a big corn silo in his backyard and painted Nowhere across it, and the name stuck. And now it's become a legitimate place name, and it's marked on maps. I've never been able to go there, but I would like to go to Nowhere. If we pull out the map of Nowhere from the national map and we separate it into its components, then we end up with its components. Here's the labels. It's in Cobb County. Here's a section number. Here's some elevations and so on. We have a series of points. They're almost entirely buildings in this reference. So they're places, buildings. We have a whole bunch of lines with things like political boundaries, roads, the dam up here on a reservoir, some streams. And then we have a series of areas which are water bodies, some very small lakes, and then mostly just patches of vegetation. Points, lines, areas, labels. Those are the content for the map. We can reduce those points, lines, and areas and labels to positions, to terms like distances, lengths, bearings, areas, the things that we're going to measure over the next few weeks. Okay, just a quick word on the map legend. What is the map legend? It's a very important element because it's sort of like your translation table between the symbology and the graphics and what it actually is in the real world, and that's communicated by language or also by text. So in the feature model, the legend is a key or an index that helps us to interpret the symbols as features. And notice that, you know, a yellow patch on the map could be pretty much anything until we have an entry in the legend that says that a yellow patch represents a wetlands or an urban area or whatever it might be. Map symbols, especially point symbols, are so common that ESRI, the major manufacturer of GIS software and the major producer of maps that you see in the popular press, at least here in North America, has put out a set of fonts that you'll find inside Microsoft Word and packages like that that are designed for doing symbology on maps. So whole font sets that are things like, here's the Esri climate. So this is a set of symbols for putting on climatic maps. Here's one that's specific to NGA. So we've got symbols that might appear on a military map directly built into the font when you just move these around. Here's a set of symbols for forestry, crime analysis, for caving, for straightforward cartography, and so on. So symbols are very important. They're embedded deeply within cartography. On USGS topographic maps, there's a set of symbols. You don't have it, but you can look it up on the internet. There's an index sheet that goes along with the national map, with all those GeoPDF files that we've worked with, that consists of literally a complete symbol listing of every symbol you could possibly imagine. I'm not going to go through them all. There are hundreds of them. But here are some examples. These are symbols that might appear as points. So things like buildings, schools, houses of worship with little flags in them, forest department headquarters, ranger offices, racetracks, airport landing strips, although this is beginning to look more like lines than an area symbol. Storage tanks, reservoirs, gauging stations on streams, boat access points, picnic areas, all the kinds of things that you might think of as being symbolically represented as a single location on a map. What kinds of things get coded as point features? Well, quite a lot of them. We deal with often human features. So the White House, for example, is a house, it's a building, it's also a government building, so it would appear as a certain symbol in a certain place and in its correct position, and often be geometrically correct. In other words, it'll have the right building footprint for the actual White House. A lot of the features are cadastral. We've seen already things like section corners and township and range markers and boundaries. These are important points on the landscape if you're out in a rural area because they pretty much define the field boundaries, the roads, and so on. And then also many of them to do with the cadastre or the land ownership also relate to the geodetic control for the land. So things like benchmarks that are often set into the landscape and then also marked on map as maps as points, often with very highly symbolized points, triangles and dots and so on. Mines and caves, very important things. Here's a mine shaft entrance. Sometimes the symbol of the mine entrance on a topographic map is literally the only indication there's a mine there. You wander around in the backcountry, often enough you'll find abandoned mine shafts all over the place. And then we've already spent quite a bit of time learning about map projections and grids, the graticules on here, the point markers, the labels, all the tick marks and so on. These are all point markers that show us something about the grid system that's being used. Even the latitude, longitude intersections are shown on the map as little crosses, vertical crosses. Okay, so lots of point features are going to appear on maps. What can we do if we've got points as far as measurement is concerned? Well, here's the whole set. This is what we can do with points. We can already talk about position, and now we know about coordinates. We know how coordinates can be stored and maintained and decoded, but we haven't dealt yet with actually taking measurements of coordinates. We're going to do that in the few classes ahead. if we've got two positions in geographic space, okay, Harold Frank Hall, 1104, west entrance, and main entrance to the USEN, we can talk about distances between those points and bearings or directions to get from one point to the other. So this has messed it up again. Let's say we've got two points and the distance between the points. Distance and a bearing. If we have a sequence of coordinates and there's some relation to them, let's say that the points taken in sequence represent a line or a series of legs or a series of steps we're going to take to navigate across the landscape, then we can talk about the length of that line, the number of points in the line, the distance of the total line and the distance of the segments. We can talk about the bearing of each segment. We can talk about things like the average bearing of the entire segment, or the amount of variation in the bearings of the segments along the line. If we have a set of points, here's just a set of points, a series of places, let's say those are mine shafts located on a topographic map, then we can talk about their list of coordinates. We can talk about measures of central tendency. So we could, for example, take the average of all the eastings and the average of all the northings of each of those mine shaft points, and it would give us the average location of all the mine shafts on that map. It would be a fictitious point that represented the whole distribution. That's what a measure of central tendency is. And then we can look at measures of variation. We can say, are they clustered around that point? Is the overall distribution clustered or uniformly spaced on the ground? So all of these measurements we're going to meet in the few classes ahead. Okay, there's the nowhere map in the background. And if we have two points and their coordinates, we can do something very simple and straightforward. We can apply the old Pythagorean theorem. Remember, we take that length and square it, and that length and square it. Add those two lengths together, take the square root of the whole thing. And we end up with the distance along the diagonal. So now we can calculate the arbitrary length of, from any one position to another position, just from the coordinates. We don't need the map anymore. We've got the coordinates. We can calculate the length from that, as long as we know the units that it's in. Notice something special here. If y2 minus y1 is either positive or negative, doesn't really make any difference because we're going to square it. So the negative sign disappears. It always comes out positive. So we always get a positive value to take the root of. We don't have to worry about direction. Okay, so lengths can be solved from coordinates, and we're going to do some of this. But we can also solve the bearings from the coordinates. Okay, now this gets a little bit hairy because we have to have different solutions for each of the four quadrants that we find ourselves in. Okay, the first, the second, the third, the fourth quadrants, depending upon whether we go north, east, south, west, back to north. We have different solutions, but you can see that the values are either positive or negative. We can simply take this distance again, and we can do a solution like this. We can take the arc sine of this length over this distance, and that gives us the angle. Okay. So it allows us to calculate the bearing. As long as we know what an arc sine is, we can, you know, that's just a function on your calculator. Don't worry about it for now. Okay, so the implication here, given any two coordinate pairs, we can calculate the distance between them, and we can compute the bearing between them. Okay, this is extremely useful for local navigation. So if we're not worrying about the projection of our map, and we are going to, let's say, follow a compass bearing from point A to point B, we can assume the Earth is flat, use the coordinates to get the distance, and calculate the bearing, follow along that bearing, and we're probably going to end up where we want to go. Notice that as we get bigger and bigger areas, that becomes less and less of a valid assumption because the Earth is curved and ellipsoidal and so on, so minor differences begin to creep in. All right, let's start with distance and my Ken Burns slide, but notice it's white, it's inverted. So if we want to measure distances on the Earth, there are lots of ways to do it. The simplest, and you might argue the natural way of measuring distances is with your own pace. And we're going to do pacing as one of the exercises in the class. So in pacing, we just simply count the number of steps we take. This is a, I'm not used to these things. This is a pedometer down here. Might even use one for fun or just for fitness. Clip it on your belt and it counts the number of steps you make in a whole day. But you could easily set it to count the number of steps you make between here and the USAN. If you know the length of your pace, and we're going to measure the lengths of our paces in class, then we can multiply the length of the pace by the number of steps and get the distance that we actually walked. The kinds of velocities that we can cover on foot and running, it's kind of handy to know. But a couple of things to notice here. This is the number of minutes that it takes to cover 1 mile in the countryside. So if we're simply walking along a highway, it's relatively flat, we're not climbing, we're doing about 4 miles per hour. It takes us 15 minutes to walk a mile. Okay. As soon as we go into open fields, we're now crossing obstacles, going up and down, jumping streams and so on, it takes us longer, about 25 minutes. We get into open woodland, now we have to go around all those trees, so we're adding length. It's taking us longer to cover the mile. We can only do 2 miles an hour. And if we're in mountains and forests and we're dealing with significant terrain up and down, then we're considerably slower. Even running, we're not doing a heck of a lot better. But if you've got a watch and you can time yourself, and then you can use the time and the pace at which you think you're walking to estimate distances, and you can actually do it extremely accurately. This is how the Himalayas were first mapped, by people estimating the distances they were walking, the time of the day, and the length of their pace. Okay, if we get to actual measurements, we often use these guys, tapes. In the old times, they were made out of chains. Now they're almost entirely made out of mylar. Mylar because it doesn't stretch when it gets hot, so it keeps the same length uniformly. You don't want something that gets hotter gets longer on a hot day. You can imagine a steel chain or a rope, which would expand when it gets wet or contract when it gets wet. Then we can also use perhaps one of these. This is a surveyor's wheel, where we just might want a simple estimate of how much carpet there is in this room. We might just take one of these and run it across the two directions and calculate the square footage that we need to use. So these are all simple ways of measuring distances on the Earth itself. If we go over slightly longer distances, then we might use a different series of techniques. We might want to continue to go in a straight line, and it's extremely difficult to follow a straight line over long distances. A trick for doing that is to use three poles to put the three poles down and get behind the last one and line them all up with each other so they're in dead straight line. Measure off the distances between the two, take the first pole and make it the third at the other end, and just keep going and adding up the distances as you go. You can follow this with enormous amounts of precision. This can be done with more precise versions of the poles to within inches over miles using this technique. It's really pretty cool. What do we do when things get in the way? I'm sorry, let me go ahead here. Here's another pedometer. Here's somebody measuring their pace and counting their paces. There are all sorts of techniques for counting paces. I've got my own patented method that rarely lets me down, so I count off in tens and hundreds. But if we're doing pacing and we're on even ground and there are no obstacles, it's fairly straightforward. If there are obstacles, that can add to the complexity. And the principal way of getting around obstacles when you're pacing, is to start at your start point, continue towards your target, so there's a destination hidden behind the tree here. When we get to the obstacle, which say this tree, you just simply, rather than walking straight forward, you simply sidestep. So let's say I go 1, 2, 3, now I can pace around the desk there. I get to the other side of it, counting my paces, I can take the same 3 steps back. And now I'm back on my original trajectory. And that works well in dense forest. It's quite amazing. It's easy to get off of your bearing when you're in a forest, but if you use that method, generally speaking, you won't screw up. When we get to much longer distances for making measurements, when we've got very long distances, when we're beyond the lines of sight, we're stuck with positioning. Okay? And fortunately, we have the ultimate tool for positioning, GPS, and we're going to be introduced to GPS in a little while. If we have shorter distances and they stay within the line of sight, and as we now know that at the height of your eyes, we can see up to about 4 kilometers into the distance. We can have instruments to magnify, so the telescope, so they can allow us to see a little further and make measurements. Often this is done with electronic distance measuring. So we'll see this kind of a pole, which has a light prism on top. This guy simply presses a button on his theodolite, as it's called, sends a pulse of light out to the prism. It gets bounced back. It calculates how long it took the light to get there. It's called trilateration. It measures the distance by speed. And then it simply reads off exactly the distance. And that's often very, very precisely measured. This is how things like archaeological digs, highways, bridges, and so on get surveyed, and things are laid out with a great deal of precision. The technology that electronic distance measuring replaced is called Stadia, and this is so flexible, you still see it around. It works without batteries, you know, it works with relatively unsophisticated equipment. The instrument looks very much like that. In fact, this theodolite can be used for exactly this, but we can also use other instruments called levels and transits to do the same measurement. And we need this guy. He's called the rod man. He's the low guy on the totem pole in the surveying team. He's the guy that simply has to stand there and hold the pole upright. It's got a little level bubble on it so you can see that it's upright. And once you have him in place, you can look through the lens at his target, and the rods are calibrated and marked off in either feet or meters usually, let's say meters, and we can simply use what are called stadia hairs or stadia calibration in the lens of the theodolite to make the measurements. So generally what our task would be to make the measurement would be to simply read off this lower stadia hair, read off the upper stadia hair, to subtract the lower from the upper value. That gives us a distance, in this case it's 0.36, and then the stadia constant for this instrument is 100, so we just multiply the 0.36 by 100 and figure that distance is 36 meters. Very straightforward, very easy to use. Almost anybody can use this after a few hours of training. Okay, those are measurements on the ground. Now what about measurements on the mat? Notice the two should line up with each other. Well, we've already looked at this method, the old paper strip method, remarkably accurate if done effectively. Now we can do that. There are a whole series of both analog and digital tools that work around wheels. These are often called map wheels, where you simply, the digital ones, you can set the scale of the map that you're working with, and then you zero it, you put it down on the first feature on the map, and just simply wheel the thing along until you get to the other end and you can read the value off, how far it is. And since you can steer them around corners and so on, you can follow roads or rivers or mountain ridges and get the distances measured accordingly. Not too expensive. I just bought one of these to photograph for my book. The other flip side of the coin, if we can measure, remember if we've got 2 points and we can calculate the direction, the distance, or we can measure the distance on the ground or from the map. Now, what about direction? Well, direction's a little bit more complicated, and as you can see, there are many things about direction that are really just sort of curves that Mother Nature throws at us. The simplest tool for measuring direction during the daytime is on my wrist. I never buy a digital watch because only analog watches work to do this. Let's say that we're out in the open. I take my watch, and I, assuming that it's correct, I point the big hand, I point the hour hand at the sun. Here's the sun up here. So here's my hour hand. I point it over, and let's say the sun's over there. It wouldn't be that way, would it? That's north. It'd be over here. And I measure off 12 o'clock on the watch, and I take that angle and I bisect it and take the opposite side of the bisection. If at least I'm in the northern hemisphere and I'm not too close to the poles, that line will be pointing north. Okay, let's try it again, closer to noon. You notice that the two come closer together, the hour hand and the 12 o'clock, with some variation because of time zone differences and so on. This will be pointing north, and here we see it later in the afternoon, the sun's beginning to set down, the hour hand's over here, 12 o'clock's over this side now, and we still bisect the angle and find north here. Okay, it's a pretty infallible method. I might have just saved one of your lives by telling you this. But what do you do at night? Well, at night it's even easier to find north. You've probably noticed this guy in the skies if you've ever looked up at night. The Big Dipper, or in Britain it's called the Plough. You really can't miss it. It's a very distinctive constellation. If we follow the last two stars of the Big Dipper, kind of like the lip of the Big Dipper, these are called the pointer stars. Just follow those until we meet the last star of the Little Dipper, then you found Polaris. Okay, the nice thing about Polaris is that it happens to be lined up almost perfectly with the axis of rotation of the Earth. So it's the point around which all the other stars appear to rotate over time. It stays still, as stable as the North Star, as Shakespeare said. Got my quotes mixed up. Easy to find. Of course, it assumes there's it's not raining or cloudy or whatever, but generally speaking, it can be seen pretty straightforwardly. Okay, I'm going to start talking about the compass now. So let's just familiarize ourselves a little bit with some of the ways that get used for actually putting numbers on bearings and directions. We've gone over how we do that with coordinates, but we've got several different ways of stating the same thing as far as the directions are concerned. Now, the oldest compasses go way back. They were generally magnetic needles floating in water, and you simply divided up the circle into a number of segments, and you gave those segments names. You know, the Greeks had it the eight winds, the Chinese, I think, had 12 or 16 directions, and so on and so forth. The way that came about nautically was to simply divide it up into quadrants, north, south, east, and west, and then divide those up into two each. So we talk about northwest, southwest, southeast, and northeast. And then we divide those again. So we talk about west, northwest, south, southwest, and so on. We got increasing number of angles, and you could go on dividing, obviously, quite a bit. If you were a seaman in the sort of pirate era, any time in before about the 18th century, one of the things you would have been required to do to become an able-bodied seaman was to memorize the points of the compass. It was called boxing the compass. It was just done by rote memorization. You just had to go around the compass and measure and recite each of the different directions. You didn't necessarily know what they meant, but this was it. This system still gets used in marine navigation, where they still call the different sides of a ship port and starboard instead of left and right. Who knows why? Sometimes these different systems just get perpetuated. Now, there's another very simple way to measure off directions, and it's often used in flight or sometimes in open field visibility. Let's say, bandits coming in at 10 o'clock high. Okay, I'm giving a clock reference and referring it to a direction. So if we start at 12, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. So 10 o'clock would be this direction out here. So we can pretend that directions are just like the time on our watches or on a clock. Again, digital clocks won't do it for you. So there's two different ways of dealing with directions. There's yet a third represented here, and that's what are called azimuths. Azimuths are simply angles. They start at zero. They go up to 90 at right angle, 180 the opposite direction, 270, and then finally back to 360 or zero. Who knows why we divide the circle into 360 points? One of the beliefs is that in the period when the ancient Arabic astronomers took over mathematics, inventing fields like algebra or algebra as we know it, they simply, at that time, they believed there were 360 days in the year, so they chose 360 as a handy number. They were wrong, of course, but 360 is a really good number because it divides by lots of different other numbers. So it's a very handy number to use, kind of like 12. Okay, so we've got hours of the clock, points of the compass, and azimuths, and all of these have been used for giving bearings, and we're going to meet several more in just a minute. Okay, some compasses. Let me introduce you to some of the major means of compasses. These two are magnetic compasses. This one's in a boat, This one's sitting on my back porch. It's the kind of compass we're going to use in class, called a Selva magnetic compass. And these consist of a magnetized needle on a pivot and floating in gel. Okay, so the gel is to absorb too rapid movement of the needle. We don't want it flowing around all over the place. So then it's sealed inside, in this case, plastic. And as long as we keep it in the plane of the Earth, it's going to be reasonably accurate. Notice we don't use a compass this way, we put it out this way. So these two are magnetic compasses, even though this one is sealed in the dashboard of a boat, it works in exactly the same principle. Not so these two. Okay. This one is actually my iPhone. Got it here. We just go to the compass app. This is probably how most people get access to compasses these days. There it is. Okay. This is getting a digital compass reading from a combination of digital compass and accelerometer. Okay. This is actually a sort of digital signal. It's measuring the Earth's magnetic field, but it's then positioning it and displaying the dial via some kind of interface. Okay, so it's kind of like fly-by-wire techniques. Turn that off. There's one more type of compass that's in common use, and that's this one. This is a gyro compass. If we have a vehicle that we need to navigate that has a lot of metal in it, and metal interacts with the Earth's magnetic field and interacts with compasses, we need some other mechanism by which to measure the Earth's magnetic field. And that's done by spinning a gyro or a gyroscope, in a controlled environment, and then measuring the deflection from the rotation due to the Earth's magnetic field. Yeah.
How accurate is the iPhone?
How accurate? To about a degree. Yeah. It's not bad, yeah. You'd be able to check it later on when we do some navigation. Just one more thing to point out. Let's give you yet another one here. This is an aircraft compass. It's a gyro compass. If you've got a big engine right in front of you in the plane, or several engines on board and a lot of metal, you definitely want to use a gyro compass. But notice that here our values go from 0 to 36. And that's because in flight, we usually leave the last 0 off the azimuth for the bearing. Okay, so when you come in to land at Santa Barbara, you don't land on the runway with an azimuth of 270 degrees, you land on runway 27. Okay, so you just lop the 0 off the end. Next time you look at those big numbers painted on the end of the runway, you'll know exactly what they mean. All right, so these are some different compasses, and they all work, and they're all very useful, and they all supply us with navigation information. A mirror compass is a major technological innovation by itself. We're going to use them in class, so I thought I'd just show some of their merits. What is a mirror compass? It's a magnetic compass with a transparent dial. I can see through it. Also has a mirror. This is not for putting on makeup or something, or signaling if you're in an emergency. The purpose of having a mirror compass is so that we can look at the compass and look at something in our line of sight at the same time. We've got a little bullseye type, sighting device at the top. We've got a line going down the center of the mirror. We've even got a little hole in the mirror here so I can see through the mirror. So I can line my line of sight up with that line and then look in the mirror and actually see the scale of the compass. I can set it to whatever I want. And then I can see through the open space here, down to the ground. Because what I want to do is to be standing over exactly the point that I want to start from. So it doesn't show super well in here, but you can see the edge of my foot right there, okay, directly beneath where I'm taking this compass bearing reading. Here's the line down the center, here's the target, and you can see the scale off here, so I can set it to any particular value, look at an object, and read the bearing off from that object through this mirror compass. If you've ever been in the armed services or spent any time in the military or Coast Guard, you'll have met one of these, usually manufactured by the Brunton Corporation. This is the military compass. It's a mirrored compass, but it has a few sort of bells and whistles on it. The most useful one is this loop down here. You can see it at the bottom. And the purpose of the loop is that you can put your thumb through it and hold the compass at arm's length. So we can actually use it like sighting a gun. You can look at a particular target, get a particular bearing, or turn to a particular bearing and see what you can see on the horizon at that particular bearing, and get a reasonably accurate guess at what's there. It's also got some other features like magnifying lenses and scales that you can measure maps off at different sizes and so on. So the military compass, extremely useful, very valuable tool. All right, azimuths. We've talked so far about three or four different ways of specifying bearings. Here's yet another one. Unfortunately, this is the one that was commonplace when most of the meets and bounds descriptions of property in the United States were created. It's called quadrats or quadrants sometimes. And here we'd simply divide the angle, the bearings up into four quadrants. 1, 2, 3, 4. So that's 0 to 90, 90 to 180, 180 to 270, 270 to 360. And then we give bearings as letter sequences like this. So S77 degrees east, that's actually a bearing. We read it like this. We say go to the south and then go 77 degrees east. So if we go to the south, turn back 77 degrees east, we end up here at south 77 east, which is the equivalent of 103 azimuth. Okay, I know it's confusing. I once failed a military test because of this. Maybe that's what got me interested in cartography to begin with. Equivalents, here are a few examples. Here's our south 77 east. Here's one in each quadrant. South 30 west. Remember, go to the south and then go 30 degrees to the west. That's 210. North 20 west. Go to the north and then go 20 degrees west. So that's this equivalent to 340 degrees. Or first quadrant, north 27 east. You simply go to the north and then turn 27 degrees towards the east. Equivalent azimuth 27. Okay, so I've now given you five different ways of expressing bearings. And people use all of them. I use azimuths for everything because they're just so simple and straightforward. All right. Now we come to the curve part where things get difficult. Wouldn't it be nice if the Earth's magnetic field was perfectly aligned with the graticule for the globe? It isn't. Okay, the north and south poles are not at the geometric north and south poles, they're offset. And the magnetic field itself, since it's formed by the density of molten materials in the Earth's subsurface, bears very little similarities with what's on the surface. Okay. So let's have a look at the variations in that. First of all, how are we going to meet them? Well, the first place you might meet them would be on a map. So here I've done a super zoom in the what's called the declination diagram, usually in the bottom corner of any topographic map, and you'll find these on the maps in the GeoPDF toolbar thing as well. Okay, we've got three lines here, three norths. Okay, giving you five different ways of specifying direction. Now I'm going to give you three norths. That's what I meant by the curve. The one with the little star on top is always true north. The little star represents Polaris. That's where we're shooting and aiming towards Polaris, the true north. We already know what GN is. It's grid north. And you can simply read down here. It says UTM grid and 1988 magnetic north declination at center of sheet. Okay, so GN stands for grid north, and it represents the UTM grid. Center of sheet, that means that the location that this is correct for is the dead middle of our map. Okay, if we went off in any direction, it's going to be slightly different. You notice my grid north is given in two ways here. At first, it's given as an angle. It says 1 degree 35 minutes. And you notice that it is to the west of true north. So you say we have west declination on the grid. We've also given it here in another system called mills. Okay. Now mills, well, I'll talk about in just a second. It's 28 mils. A mil is 1 over 6,400th of a circle. 6,400. 1 over 6,400. 6,400 mils in a circle. And you'll see the significance of that in just a minute. It has to do with radian conversions in the actual repetition of a circle. Okay, so why is our grid north not aligned with true north? Well, because of now what we know about UTM, right? It depends where we are with respect to the central meridian for the map. If we are on the central meridian, in other words, if our easting is 500,000, then magnetic north and grid north should be perfectly aligned. As I move to either side, I get variations, and grid north and magnetic north get slightly apart. Okay? So this is the first thing to beware of. If I'm using a map to calculate bearings, I have to know whether I'm going with respect to the edges of the map, which are parallel to latitude and longitude, or to the grid on the map, which is parallel to UTM, and offset from the grid by 1 degree, 35 minutes. Okay. Now let's say I want to use a compass. Here's magnetic north, or MN, and it has its own little symbol, that kind of half an arrow, which sort of means the magnetic arrow of the compass. Kind of looks like a compass needle pointing. And we can see that the magnetic north declination is in the opposite direction. It's east of true north in this case. So we say we have east declination at this point. And here's the amount, 14 degrees. It's huge. 14 degrees is a pretty significant angle. Or 249 mils. Okay, so problem number one, these values are going to vary depending upon where we are in the world. If we want to use a compass on a particular map, we need to know what the declination is on that map. Okay? Here's a little bit about the mills. You might say, why throw yet another? That's now your sixth way of specifying bearings into here. And it has to do with, actually it has to do with artillery and estimating distances. Now, the military is very big on estimating how far away things are. And the nice thing about mils is that they have a 1 to 1,000 ratio. That's the way it works out. So if you have a known object size, then you can use this object size and the number of mils that it subtends to estimate the distance away that it is. Okay, so for example, if an object 1 meter on the side, that's a little bit less than this table, would subtend 1 mil at 1 kilometer. So if I measured at the angle of a 1 meter object at 1 kilometer, that's quite a distance away, that would be 1 mil, 1/64 hundredth of a circle. Okay, so the only problem then is how do we estimate how many mils something is subtending, and we need to know approximately how big things are. Well, this is why in the military you memorize how big, say, a jeep is, or how long a tank is, or how wide a tank is if you're seeing it end on. And then you can use these handy little methods. If we spread a whole hand out and put it at the end of our arm length and look into the distance, it's subtending 300 mils. The fist, 180. The four fingers, 125. Too bad, I have to read it off here. Three fingers is 100, two fingers is 70, and a single finger is 30 mils. Okay? So if I hold my hand up like this and I look at an object on the horizon that I think is a meter wide, subtending 30 mils, I can calculate how far away that object would be. Okay? Very handy thing to be able to do. All right, unfortunately I don't get a lot of time for this lecture, but let's go on and look at declination. This is a map using contour lines to show declination of magnetic north. Okay. It divides basically up into two parts. You notice that over on this side of the map, it's increasingly values increasing away from this, the zero line. The U.S. is very fortunate in that, you know, starting about here in New Orleans and then crossing right up in Mississippi, and following on through into Canada, we have a line of zero declination. So in other words, our maps are going to line up. Magnetic north and true north are going to be the same thing. That's not the case as we go further out here. So the example I gave you... The example I gave you here shows magnetic north with an easterly declination. Okay, and then true enough, over here we have declinations east, increasing as I go further east. But you notice it's kind of an unusual pattern. We go up to Alaska here, it begins to loop back on itself, the declination, because we've gone beyond where the pole lines up with the magnetic pole. And then here we have west declination, which pretty much linearly increases out over the east coast and then does its flips and weird patterns over here as well. Okay. So wouldn't it be nice if we knew the declination and we could have a map like this, we could, you know, pre-measure it everywhere in the country and then just simply figure out what it is and apply that at any point. Well, unfortunately, it changes as well. Now, this is a global pattern, by the way, of the equivalent we just saw for the United States. So we saw this part. We've got the zero line, the green line, coming up the center of the country with the east declination here, west declination here. Notice things get really hairy here. Here's the south magnetic pole. And we get these weird things where the curves bend. And look at this big loop here in the South Atlantic. We've got zero lines that come down, almost meet here over Burma and so on, and then come back again. Very, very complicated patterns of the Earth's magnetic field. Okay. Now, here's the other complicating factor. Here's an animation of that map over time, since about the 1600s. And as you can see, the poles are moving around. Okay, the geometric poles, the actual poles of rotation, move very, very slightly, but the magnetic poles move quite a bit. And this has enormous consequences for the declination. Just watch it coming up in the 1800s now, so things are significantly moving around. Coming into the 20th century, and we start over again in the 1600s. So nothing stays the same. Declination is not a constant. It's changing all the time. This is a map showing you the amount of the annual the amount and direction of the annual change in declination. Okay, so sometimes east is becoming more east, or east is tending towards west, decreasing declination, and vice versa, and so on. So as you can see, most of the change is centered around the South Pole, but there are other places in the Earth where the change is quite significant. Northern Alaska is one of them. So it would be nice if we knew the declination anywhere, anytime, straightforwardly, so that we could calculate it at any point. Well, fortunately, we can do that. Isn't the internet wonderful? You can go to the National Geophysical Data Center, and they have a tool here for looking at the Earth's magnetic field and its declinations. And so what we need to do is to put into here the latitude and longitude, and it has a thing where you can look it up by zip code and so on in here as well. We need to put in a date, because, you know, let's say we know we're going to the field a week from Friday, we'd like the declination from then. Or we did our field work in 1977, what the heck was the declination then? We can use this website to calculate what the declination was at any given period of time. Okay. Declination's critical. Remember, you're going to encounter it. The usual way that we try to deal with it is that we make these guys adjustable. This one is not. But we often allow magnetic compasses to have a little screw adjustment. They often come with a little screwdriver on the end of a string that you can use to adjust and actually turn the scales so that you can counter the declination so that the actual compass points true north rather than magnetic north. Otherwise, you can always apply the corrections after the fact. You know that everything's going to be too big or too small. Okay, reasonably on time. This is what we met today. We met the map model. Met it before, but now we're looking at it from a different point of view because we're seeing the map, literally the paper or the screen map, as a representation of reality. Now we can measure the real world, or we can measure the map. It's much easier to measure the map, trust me. We learned that the maps consist of things that have dimensions, points, lines, areas, and text. And we can apply different measures to points, lines, and areas, and use them to calculate different things. We're going to go over many of those calculations for the next few weeks. We've dealt with point symbols on topographic maps. I gave you some examples of what kinds of things are shown as point locations. They're not always pure points. Sometimes they occupy a little area. We can measure distance and direction from the map by measurement, with a measurement instrument. We can measure it on the Earth by measurement instruments, or we can measure it in either using coordinates. So if we can calculate coordinates, they're very handy because they take us away from the Earth and away from the map and allow us to make independent calculations. And then the last one, grid north, true north, the magnetic north, are not just not the same thing, but they vary as a function of time. So if we get confused and use the wrong one, we can really make ourselves get truly lost. Okay, see you all on Friday.
Yeah.
I deliberately didn't mention it because I'm going to talk about it in the next section.
Because I was out in the field, I was up in the June Lake by Mammoth Lakes with a graduate student here. We had to measure the direction, the azimuth, the bearing of the where we were taking core samples out of the tree.